You're listening to event audio from the Brookings Events Podcast, part of the Brookings Podcast Network. For more in-depth analysis and commentary from Brookings scholars and our guests, go to brookings.edu/podcasts or listen via Apple Podcasts, on Spotify, or your favorite podcast app. Don't forget to follow us on Twitter at Policy Podcasts.
Good afternoon. I'm David Wessel. I'm director of the Hutchins Center at the Brookings Institution. And I'm very pleased to join with our partners at the Rosenberg Institute of Global Finance, the Brandeis University International Business School, the Olin Business School at WashU in St. Louis, and the Harris School of Public Policy at the University of Chicago to kick off our ninth annual Municipal Finance Conference, which seeks to bring together academics, people in the municipal bond business, and public sector officials to think about both the municipal capital markets and state and local fiscal issues generally. I'm sorry we have to do this virtually this year, but it does mean that we have a somewhat broader audience. You can watch the majority of today's sessions right here on this event page. There are my interview in a few minutes with Mary Libby Schaff from Oakland and two subsequent panels on COVID, the state and local response, followed by the muni bond response and outlook. At 3:45 Eastern, we'll head to two concurrent breakout sessions. These will take place only on Zoom. If you registered, you should get an email. If you didn't register and you want to get the Zoom coordinates, you can email my colleague Stephanie Sensula, that's S-C-E-N-C-U-L-A at brookings.edu or events@brookings.edu, and they'll send you the details. A reminder, we'll start tomorrow morning at 8:30 Eastern with breakouts and then convene again plenary at 10:15. And if you have any trouble, just let us know. We'll try and sort everything out. So I'm very pleased to have Libby Schaff join us today. She's the mayor of Oakland, which is, I've learned, the 45th largest city in the United States, 433,000 people. Of the 482 cities in California, Oakland is among 14 that are rated AA1 by Moody's. That's second only to a AAA rating. And in February, when they rated the city, they talked about the very strong fiscal position, strengthened fiscal policies, experienced prudent management, I guess that means you, Mayor, and said they were well positioned for its clear fiscal and social challenges, including increasing pension costs, sharply increased homelessness, and declining housing affordability, and that was all before COVID. Libby Schaff is a native of Oakland. She ran for class president her senior year at Skyline High School and lost, but she's been winning elections ever since. She's a lawyer. She's been involved in local government since starting a volunteer program in the public schools in 1995. And she spent a couple of years in the mid-2000s as a special assistant to Jerry Brown when he was mayor of Oakland, which must have been interesting. Libby Schaff was elected to the city council in 2010, elected mayor in 2014 in the only in California 14th round of ranked choice voting. She had quite a first term. There was the ghost ship fire that killed 36 young artists and musicians, prostitution scandal in the police department, the Oakland Raiders decided to leave for Las Vegas, and the municipal workers went on strike. For reasons that defy logic, she decided to run again for office and was reelected in 2018, just in time to handle COVID and Black Lives Matter. Libby Schaff and her husband, Sal, who's a physicist and software engineer, have two kids who attended the very same public school, elementary school, that she did. And so we're very happy to welcome her to the Municipal Finance Conference. So Mayor Schaff, I thought perhaps it would be useful to start with COVID. As sitting atop a city government, a city the size of Oakland, how has COVID affected you, in addition to the obvious public health challenges, in a budget sense?
Well, fiscally, we immediately had to cut $122 million out of a 14-month period in our budget.
And that's so how big is the budget? That's
Our budget is about $1.6 billion. So, you know, percentage-wise, I mean, that's a lot of money, but percentage-wise, it wasn't catastrophic. But it is literally the biggest cut we've ever needed to make immediately. You know, there was no easing into this. Our revenues, you know, several revenue categories just fell off a cliff. Now, we had, when I became the mayor, we started a rainy day fund. And luckily, that had done relatively well because of Oakland's real estate boom. Our rainy day fund is actually tied to our real estate transfer tax. So it's very unpredictable, but it had been doing well. And so we took this opportunity, and it's a tremendous risk. And believe me, I was practically crying because all the good fiscal policies that you mentioned that got us that credit upgrade, we really, we either suspended them to make this budget cut, or like I said, we cleaned out our rainy day fund, both from this current last fiscal year and this current fiscal year to get us through. But the good news is we did not lay off a single person. We did not freeze all our positions. We did freeze some of them, but we were able to be very strategic and surgical. And that is allowing us to get through this year, because at the end of the day, at the moment when our budget has been most impacted is the moment that our residents need us the most. We are in this economic meltdown. Our people are not working. They're frightened. They need our support now more than ever. And so I really want to hand it to my finance staff. Adam Benson is our director of finance, who has just been a wizard of really thoughtfulness, because we have got to continue to think about the long term. We have taken a risk. We did a lot of one-time revenues funding ongoing services and salaries, which is a no-no. But we felt like this crisis warranted that. But we are holding our breath with the hope that, you know, this is the V recovery, that we are going to recover relatively soon and relatively quickly. Next year, we're going to have to make some much harder decisions if that, in fact, does not come to pass.
When you say next year, so you're now in fiscal year 2021, right?
So the budget. Yes, we just started our new fiscal year. We just passed our new budget. Although I will tell you that our city council voted to schedule a potential revision of the budget in response to all the protests and the calls for defunding the police. So I am advocating for no financial changes. There could be some policy changes, but I am very worried about kind of responding to a huge amount of political pressure with something that really needs to be constructed in a way that keeps the long term, not just the moment, in mind.
But I thought your city council had voted to cut the police budget by $14 million from the $300 million. Is that not a final decision?
We shall see. The city council always has the authority to do further revisions to the budget after they've passed it. And we did. We cut $14.3 million out of the police department. And much more importantly, we funded more than $2 million to create a new non-law enforcement response system. And that is something that I think we're going to see cities across the country doing, to create something that can respond to 911 that does not have a gun and a badge, but our trained medics, our trained crisis intervention specialists, therapists that are more trauma-informed and are there to provide care, not arrest, not law enforcement. And so in Oakland, we're calling this MACRO. I know we've actually been preparing for this for over a year. So we started this long before this particular movement, long before the tragic murder of George Floyd. But I think lots of cities are going to be looking to create this new type of trauma-informed response that is not so tied to law enforcement.
So these will be new hires, a new core of people who are non-police intervention specialists?
It will be. And I wouldn't be surprised if we're going to be linking in with, for example, our community health clinics, organizations that already have ties and relationships and trust built within certain communities. For example, Oakland has a large undocumented worker community. Often these people are afraid to call the police. And so to have culturally competent, trusted people available to respond, we actually might get more people reaching out to government in their time of need so that we can help them.
Interesting. So it seems to me that times like these, there are two things that happen simultaneously. One is one has to respond to the crisis, whether it's COVID or Black Lives Matter. And then the other is to say this can accelerate reforms and changes. You referred to it in a conversation we had earlier as it seems a little weird, the silver lining of a crisis like this. So what kind of things are you thinking about that you can do or should do in Oakland, given that we have this moment where people are open to changes that 6 or 9 months ago they might not have been open to?
Well, first of all, I believe that a crisis like COVID, at least in Oakland, I am telling you, it has unleashed the entrepreneurial bureaucrats within our organization.
How many of those are there?
There are tons of them. Release them. You know, set them free. They're amazing. And, you know, I'll give you a very simple example. Our Department of Transportation realized that they had all this traffic analysis that they had done for our bike plan. And we repurposed that analysis to create the Slow Streets program. We identified immediately 74 miles, it's 10% of the roads in Oakland, that could be used for what we call, you know, appropriate, healthy, socially distanced exercise. So we've begun every weekend, we've shut off a number of streets to through traffic. It's still available for local traffic. Your Amazon delivery will get there, but it's closed off to through traffic so families and neighbors can walk around the neighborhood. And it's helped us relieve the pressure on our popular parks. We have a beautiful lake in the middle of our city that has been getting overcrowded, which is terrible during COVID. So, I mean, that is silver lining thinking. But the bigger pieces are really to recognize how COVID is just shining a hot spotlight on racial inequality, on our structural racism. The way that our systems, our policies, our practices are, you know, regardless of the good intentions of those of us in local government, we are continuing to preserve and in many cases exacerbate these inequalities. And so we have this crisis called COVID. Can we use this as we're getting people to come to free community testing sites because they are afraid of death? Can we use this as an opportunity to connect people that didn't have a health home at all with a long-term permanent community health home? Can we take this moment where families, their children cannot get education without the tools for distance learning? Can we take this moment to close the digital divide for good, not only because every child deserves to continue their education, but because in this day and age, your employability, your ability to access information, public benefits is so restricted if you do not have digital connectivity. And so, for example, in Oakland, we launched something called Oakland Undivided. And in 6 days, we raised $13 million from philanthropy. And I want to do a special shout out for Jack Dorsey, the founder of Twitter and Square, who personally donated $10 million of his personal money so that we can get a device, an internet connection, and most importantly, technical support into the homes of the 25,000 Oakland Public Schools student families that had no connectivity. And that technical support is key. But I will say, because of COVID, because of sheltering in place, and because of distance learning requirements, these families will never have a larger motivation to actually adapt and learn technology. So I know that sounds like a terrible silver lining, But these are the types of opportunities that we have to take advantage of in a way where we're not just responding to the crisis, but we are doing some long-term changes so that when we come out of this, we can return not to business as usual, but to a more equitable, just society.
And you think that the municipal government of the size of Oakland has the resources to address all those issues?
Listen, we have to have, you know, an abundance mindset. And I believe that the only way we're going to change the world is through public-private partnerships. Again, COVID, I believe, has kind of unleashed our entrepreneurial bureaucrats. We're seeing cities move faster and more creatively and with more risk-taking tolerance than in normal times. Mm-hmm. And then we're also seeing philanthropy step forward and saying, if you've got a crazy good idea, Mayor, we will help you test it. And if the test shows that it is successful, then we can make the case to bring it back to government to scale and institutionalize. And that's part of what I am very excited to do with the Mayors for a Guaranteed Income. You know, this idea of a universal basic income is one that's been kicked around for a while. Government has seemed very reluctant to test it out. But because of COVID, we have some aspects of it. You know, the federal government did just, you know, stimulus checks to individuals. Right. It's a very similar idea. So clearly people are maybe having a bit more comfort with it. But this is our opportunity to rethink how we support people in meeting their basic needs, especially in high cost places like the Bay Area, where the minimum wage is nowhere near the living wage.
Right. Can you talk a little bit about homelessness in Oakland and what a municipal government can do to confront, which is just an obvious and very visible problem?
Well, homelessness is another just tragedy that has deep ties into structural racism. And I don't think that that's something that a lot of municipalities, and remember, so much of what we look at when we think about homelessness is tied to county government and the county's functions with public health and behavioral health and the social safety net. But we really need to see how our housing policies have created the housing shortage, which has driven up prices. The fact that such a wealthy country, such a wealthy state, such a wealthy region cannot provide the most basic need of shelter to all people. And I want to just illustrate this, if you don't mind, with a story. When I began my journey in addressing homelessness, because I knew that I couldn't just keep saying it's the county's responsibility, Oakland has seen homelessness double in just 4 years. But I met a man whose name was Bishop Emery, and he lived under the freeway just a few blocks from the home where he was born and raised with 9 other siblings. And it was... This story is more common than you would think. We have found through surveys the vast majority of the homeless in our city are actually from our city, or at least from Alameda County. And when you look at how, for example, public housing doesn't allow extra people to come in on the lease, or the over-incarceration of African Americans, the overcharging of them and the high bail that's set, all these things that exacerbate the removal of this one group of people that is just overly burdened with things like a felony on the record, which again limits their housing abilities and even limits the ability of their family members to bring them in and take care of them. We have to see how all those different institutions and their failures, particularly for the Black and Brown populations, are exacerbating homelessness. So that is one lesson we've learned. The other lesson that we've learned is that in order to get people off of the street to come indoors, they really need the four P's. And that is, they need to go to bed at night with their possessions safely secured, with their partner, with their pets. And one thing that very few shelters offer is privacy. And so in Oakland, we actually have doubled our shelter capacity, but by using some innovative models, something called cabin communities, and also safe RV parks. And one of the unforeseen benefits of these models is that they are physically distanced. And so when COVID broke out, we saw San Francisco having to move, you know, more than 500 unsheltered people out of shelters and into these emergency hotels because the shelters were not safe and they were having these horrible breakouts. In Oakland, we only had to move 53 people from our traditional shelters because all the new shelter we had done had this privacy piece in it. So that is something that I hope people look at as we start to unravel this absolute travesty of homelessness. And the sad thing I will share about Bishop Emery, we got him into one of our very first cabin communities. And then we again, for every cabin community, we have exit resources to try and as quickly as possible get people into public housing or affordable subsidized housing. And I visited Bishop Emery just before Christmas in his first own apartment, one that he could afford. He had the Bible open on his kitchen counter. He was so happy. And then just a couple months later, he passed away. And so every day that we leave people outdoors, especially our elders, especially our disabled, we are sending them on a death sentence. This is a true urgency. Housing is health, and it's something that we really must attend to. And the silos in government are really a barrier to what really must be a sustainable solution to this.
And just sort of those of us who are uninitiated, what is a cabin community?
We use little cabins. I mean, honestly, the first one we did, and again, this was a public-private partnership where we're taking risks in Oakland to see what works. We actually use tough sheds. We don't use tough sheds anymore, but we literally use small little, I forget the dimensions, but they're maybe like 12 by 12. They are not big. They have double-paned windows because they tend to be close to freeways. We've been able to lease free land from Caltrans, our you know, highway system. Double-paned windows, drywall, sockets so that people can charge their every unsheltered person I know has a cell phone. That is one thing they all have. But it allows them to go to bed at night. It's two people per cabin, except for after COVID. If people are not in a partnership, then we allow them to have singles. But people can have their pets, their possessions. They go to bed behind a locked door on each site. And they're usually 20 cabins, 40 people per site. There are two full-time navigators that are helping people heal and move into permanent housing and move into sustainable income. And then there's shared, you know, porta potties and a communal tent with a TV and a microwave and two hot meals a day. And that's, and then a shower that comes by. So that's how they work. You can pop them up pretty quickly, and they are about half the cost of a traditional navigation center with pretty much the same rate of actual permanent rehousing.
Interesting. Before we end, I want to turn to the whole question of pension liabilities and retiree health. I know that you in Oakland got a deal with your unions to put some caps on retiree health. And so I'd like to hear how that came to be. And then quickly, if you could just talk about your relationship with CalPERS and whether it works for the municipality or whether you feel like you're a pimple on the hide of a big elephant.
Oh, well, that is your analogy, not mine, but I'll take it. I feel like a pimple. but first with the good news. Yes, we were, and I want to give thanks to my former city administrator, Sabrina Landreth, who, I mean, these things do not happen overnight. round after round of union negotiations, we have been trying to get some cost sharing on the increases in our medical costs, as well as a cap on the retiree medical for our public safety. And we were finally able to get our police union to offer that up. I will be honest, we did not get it willingly out of our fire union. We actually had to go to binding arbitration, and we got it through binding arbitration. But that one change to cap the retiree medical in our very first year, when you know our actuarial reports were run, our unfunded liabilities were reduced by $250 million, $250 million reduction in our long-term liabilities because of that one negotiated change. And I hope that's true. You didn't warn me you were going to ask me that question, but I have those numbers memorized because I care about these things so much. I really geek out over unfunded liabilities. And you know, I want to say, don't underestimate the intelligence of your constituents. I have really enjoyed, I have a little core of, I call them budget ambassadors. And we actually train them up on the complexities of the budget. And they go out into their own communities and hold little town halls and bring us back questions. I think it's really important that people get educated about even these arcane things. And it helps. When you need the public to weigh in, they know what they're talking about and they know why it's so important. Because especially in places with you know, term limited politicians, it is very easy to kick that can down the road. And as somebody who feels like a few cans landed in my lap, let us all take a pledge to think long term, to always keep that long-term vision going. You know, that is my mantra. And as you put so well, David, I got dealt many crises as the mayor of Oakland. But every crisis I got, my question I would ask myself, my grounding question is, what is in the long-term interest of Oakland, my hometown? Because I plan to die here. I plan for my children to be able to stay here and thrive here. And I want everyone's children to be thriving in Oakland. And the decisions that we make today, especially right now, will determine the health and well-being of generations. So let's not just look at our spreadsheets. Let's remember that behind every number is a family, is a person who is striving to meet their basic needs and hopefully do more, and that is thrive. Someone put it really well during the Black Lives Matter and the George Floyd protests recently. She was angry. And she said, people keep asking why we're burning our community. This isn't our community. We don't own anything. The social contract is broken. So let us fix it. That is what we came to public service to do.
So I should end on that because that was very inspirational, but my tradition in these interviews, and I didn't warn you about this, I'm sorry, is to ask every public official with a job as trying as yours, how you and your husband manage the work-life balance with you when you have two kids, 12 and 14. So what's the, how hard is that, and what have you found that makes it work, if it works? I hope it works.
Well, I'm not sure if I am an example of good work-life balance. I don't know if any mayor is, but I will say I am blessed to have a great partner, one who washes lots of dishes and does the laundry and is a really good cook. My children, you know, definitely have advanced gender norms. I want to say, you know, we all find our motivation, but this is my passion. I have always been so in love with my city. I am so proud to be from Oakland. I'm so proud of what Oakland stands for. And so it really is just getting the energy from the incredible people I get to work around. Again, I think public service attracts the best and brightest. And but it is wonderful to go home to a very, very happy home with beautiful children, although they are teenagers, so they try me sometimes. But yeah, I mean, I think during COVID, we're all just recognizing how blessed we are to have families, to have friends. And that is, again, someone who grew up, you know, I still have friends. My best friend has been my best friend since fourth grade. And, you know, that's why we're in this business. Again, not the numbers on spreadsheets, but people. And that's, I think, what keeps us all going.
Okay. Well, Mayor Schaff, thank you very much for your time. And thank your kids for sparing a half hour out of your vacation to join us today. We appreciate it. And we wish you the best of luck in these very trying times.
Thank you, David. And thank you to everyone who's tuning in today. Good luck to us all.
So, folks, if you just stay with us for a minute or so, we're going to transition to the next panel, which will be led by my colleague, Louise Shaner from the Hutchins Center. And we'll look at first the fiscal and issues raised by COVID in state and local governments. And then following that, my co-partner in this project, Rich Rifle from WashU, will turn up with another panel, this one on municipal finance.
Okay. I guess we're all here. So we'll get started on the second panel. Okay, here we go. So welcome, everybody. I'm Louise Shaner, as David mentioned, from the Hutchins Center at Brookings. And in this session, we're going to be talking about state and local responses to the COVID-19 pandemic. Before I introduce our panelists, let me remind viewers that they can submit questions for the panelists by emailing events@brookings.edu or by joining the conversation on Twitter using MuniFinance, #MuniFinance, to join Twitter. Okay, so now let me introduce our three panelists. First, we have Lauren Larson from the Director of the Governor's Office of State Planning and Budgeting for the state of Colorado. We have Fitzroy Lee, who is the Chief Economist for the District of Columbia. And we have Mike Pagano, who is Dean of the University of Illinois at Chicago College of Urban Planning and Public Affairs and the Director of the Government Finance Research Center there, and also a non-resident senior fellow of the Brookings Institution in the Metro Program, and someone who's been monitoring city for its fiscal conditions for forever. With that, we're going to get started. I didn't do a lot in terms of the impressive bios of all the panelists, and you can find them on our event page. But with 45 minutes, I thought we'd just get into it. Okay. So I want to start with first Lauren and then Fitzroy and then Michael about what you're looking at in terms of your revenue forecast post-COVID. And just what kind of numbers are you looking at and how did you get those and, you know, what was that process? So Lauren.
Good morning. Thank you, Louise. And it's nice to be sharing this time with you all. Greetings from sunny Colorado. I also serve on the National Association of State Budget Officers Executive Committee. And so I can speak for what we're seeing in Colorado and then some experiences for other states as well. Colorado published updated our forecast most recently in June, and we're showing about a 16% revenue decline in our general fund over the fiscal year that just closed and into fiscal 21. We're on July to June fiscal year. We burned through about 2/3 of our reserves just in the last few months of the fiscal year, which was tough for budget setting for 21. We do now, our General Assembly has set a new budget, and it was very tough because as drastic as that revenue drop is, there's still another 25-30% on top of that to figure out the budget gap, because a budget gap is, we have cost increases, you have a revenue decline, plus you have cost increases, you got to combine the two to get your budget gap. So things are looking pretty grim. We're looking at a square root recovery right now with a bounce back, an immediate bounce back, assuming no big second wave. But a slower return to normal. And that has us forecast, we're down about $1 billion in the third forecast year, which is fiscal 22.
Great. And Fitzroy?
Sure. Good afternoon, everyone. So much like Lauren said, we're also looking at lower revenue forecasts. For us, it's about just a little over $700 million in our current fiscal year. Our 2020 fiscal year doesn't end until September. And that's about 9% of our total revenues. And then for next fiscal year, we're still in the process of the planning that budget. The mayor sent it to the council, and just last week, the council had a first vote on that budget, and we're looking at a $707 million in lower revenues than we had in the previous forecast. The District Home Rule Act requires that we do quarterly revenue forecasts. And we're looking at another forecast right at the beginning of August. Just like Lauren, we're looking at as you call it, a square root type recovery. So we were forecasting an 8% drop in GDP, state GDP, for the second quarter, and then we have it slowly recovering, and we don't recover to our pre-COVID peak until the fourth quarter of calendar year 2021.
And maybe Mike, you can talk about the city kind of outlook and how they're being affected and what they're planning on.
Thank you, and good afternoon to everyone. As Louise mentioned, I've been involved with monitoring city fiscal conditions for several decades now in collaboration with the National League of Cities. We are just now getting the data from the survey that we sent out recently. And not unexpectedly, that quite a few of the municipalities are, as you would imagine, and as they Lauren mentioned, is happening in Colorado and Fitzroy in Washington, D.C., drawing down reserves, ending balances, rainy day funds, budget stabilization funds, or whatever, is a fairly common strategy. And we estimated that nearly a third of the municipalities drew down at least 10% of their reserves just for FY20. Again, the fiscal years end anywhere from the first part of April to the end of December. So it's during their fiscal years. And approximately a similar percentage will be drawing down their more than 10% next year. So I think the first response or reaction we get to such a dramatic damage to budgets, unlike what most recessions are, which it sort of rolls in, is that the reserves, which is what they're for, and that they were at their highest historic levels just in FY19, so that they could be used to help cushion the blow a bit. Also, just to note that only a third of the cities are drawing down more than 10% of their ending balances, but that I'm a little cautioned about that, and that is that a lot of municipalities are losing revenue from the kinds of activities that would be affected when people don't go to restaurants or hotels or to the amusement park. But a lot of cities rely more heavily on their property tax receipts, and the property real estate values, even if they do drop a bit, aren't going to be measured in property tax liabilities until next year or the year after. So I think what we're seeing with those 10 or 30, a third of the municipalities that are drawing down so much now, those are the ones that rely on the sales tax and the income tax as their primary general tax sources.
So, you know, one of the things that I see economists have done a lot of is sort of look at the experience of past recessions to try to understand what the revenue and spending implications might be for this one. You both mentioned some things that are obviously that this is a different kind of recession, particularly in the speed at which activity shut down. But I sort of think of so many other kind of pieces to it. I mean, just starting on the tax revenue, you know, do we think the tax revenue effects are going to be different because of this, like not going to some highly taxed activities like hotels and restaurants? Is that a big deal, or is mostly an income tax that should sort of follow typical relationships between taxes GEP. Anybody?
I guess I can start with that because one thing you mentioned is the speed with which it happened. So going into the forecast, the usual trajectory for these things is that, you see a weakening in the economic activity and there's a trend and you can forecast from that. This time, the lockdown was immediate and we knew that, the world was different from what it was before. The problem, though, is that we had no data to go on because all the economic data lags by, several months. And so that was kind of the first challenge for us, and which makes it very different from, say, the Great Recession, where we started with a stock market crash and then you could see it leading into a recession. So we had that challenge to begin with. One of the things that we did, we had already started doing that, is to look at more high frequency data. And so we started to gather what high frequency data we had. Of course, for Washington, D.C., we're very, very dependent, at least in our sales tax revenue, on, the hospitality sector. And so we knew that that was going to devastate our revenue. So we started looking at credit card spending data on a weekly basis. We also look at mobile phone data that tracks the number of people coming into the city. And from that, we were able to get an idea of how much reduction. Also, of course, one critical piece has been the unemployment insurance claims. Looking at we were able to get that on a daily basis. So we were able to track where the layoffs were occurring. And so for us, in terms of revenue, the biggest impact was on the sales tax revenue. About 18% of our total revenues from sales tax, and about 50% of that comes from the hospitality sector. So that was the biggest piece of revenue. For the individual income tax, of course, we saw with the layoffs that it was going to take a hit on the withholding immediately. The hit is not as big as the job losses. We are forecasting a 93,000 job loss between January and July. But because it's usually lower wage jobs, it's not as big a hit on our withholding. And a lot of the higher wage jobs in, federal government, a lot of professional and technical services that supports the federal government, a lot of those people are still working from home. So we've been seeing the withholding doing better than we had forecasted back in April, at least. And we expect, because the stock market, it won't hit until next year. So we haven't been able to assess the final returns yet because of the deferrals. And for real property tax, the first half payments came in because we have first half is due in March and it didn't start hitting until March. But we're waiting to see in September when the second half payments are due, what the delinquencies might mean in terms of our revenue. But that's where we are now. And we're going to be looking at all the data come August.
Okay. We don't have to answer every question by every person. So if someone wants to jump in on something on that wasn't mentioned, go ahead. Otherwise, I'll ask some other questions. Yeah.
I'll just pop in, Luis, on the NASPO data shows during the Great Recession, the average revenue decline among states was 11.6% over 2 years. And we don't have data in from all 50 states yet, but we're certainly well exceeding that on this trajectory. So faster and deeper.
And I would just add that it took a long time to grow back out of the 2007-2000, the Great Recession, to where, at least for municipalities, the general fund revenues didn't return to their 2007 levels until 2019. So if this is a V-shaped recession, or whatever it's called, will the fiscal benefits come back as quickly as the V or as the GDP, or will it lag quite a bit as it did to the Great Recession?
So that's on the tax side. Then when we think about the spending side, the mayor mentioned that this huge gap coming, not just from falling revenues, but also just kind of exploding expenditures. One of the first questions in that, I guess, is more of a city thing is, what are school districts doing? I mean, are they going to be spending more money to try to accommodate it? Can they? Or what are their needs there when we think about that? Mike?
Very briefly, school districts are suffering besides the great uncertainty about how they're going to open, but they're suffering on the revenue side on probably a lag property tax receipt. And I think Fitzroy pointed out correctly that it's the number of delinquencies that are going to affect whether the property tax receipts this year will be close to last year's. But what where school districts in particular are going to be facing a dilemma is when the state's revenues are well under, as Lauren just mentioned, well under what happened after the when the Great Recession hit, the 11% or so. Where are the what do states consider to be discretionary? Typically, K through 12, they're not hammered as hard as higher education, but K through 12, again, it's going to be a state question. The other question I think for K through 12 education is, if they do come back and they come back in a modified form where you're going to have maybe only parts of the student body come back at any one time and the day is extended and you have more public health officials within that the costs are going to escalate rather dramatically, and how to cover the escalating costs as state revenue is declining and property taxes are at least going to hold their own for this year. I think that's going to be the big dilemma for school districts.
And Lauren, when you, as a state official, thinking about, I guess, grants to state to local districts, how do you balance that? You know, do you say, well, we just have to get more money to do this, or what's that conversation like?
Sure. Yeah, our budget just passed had to reduce our state share to K-12 by 10%. Fortunately, though, and I'm extremely grateful to the Treasury Department for their implementation of the CARES Act. They've we're able to share some of the CARES Act funds with school districts for those expenses, increased expenses they have. Also, the Treasury Department is permitting second order effects. So we're using, in Colorado, we're using that as support for our workforce. So to the extent districts can increase instructional hours, mitigate loss learning for students, things that support parents to get back to work, they can program their CARES Act dollars for those expenses as well. And we're grateful for that tool.
I'm sorry. So let's just be clear. So the CARES Act provided $150 billion in aid to states that was supposed to be basically just for corona-related expenditures. And so I think there was some big question about whether or not how expansive the definition of corona-related expenditures would be and whether or not we could think of this as a pot of money. And you're saying that it actually has turned out to be fairly flexible, that could be used for things that you might have thought, not have thought were sort of direct. And that's the U.S. Treasury Department who's allowed that? Is that what you...
Yeah, I mean, flexible's in that certainly not the word everyone's using, but I was the chief of the Treasury branch at OMB, and I have deep respect for the Treasury Department and the constraints, under the constraints of the statute, they've put forth some guidance that allows states and localities to spend the funds on second order effects, which is very, very useful for some of the meeting these increased costs that districts have and for supporting the workforce needs that's going to keep our economy going. Colorado's number one risk before COVID hit was our risk to our workforce, to our skilled workforce in the state. And so that for us, this is a critical piece of our economy.
Fitzroy, is that your experience?
Yeah, and that has been our experience. I was just going to add that we have found that it has had more flexibility than we thought initially. And as part of when the mayor presented the budget, use of that fund was a critical part, shifting around some of the local funds that we found in talking back and forth with OMB that we could actually use that in some non-direct COVID-related spending.
But do I take it from what all of you have said, Mike, too, that so all this advice for school districts to do all this stuff to make it safe to go back to school will be a heavy lift, given still the really constrained financing they face, and that's a need? Does that seem correct?
Yeah, I would only add that I think if we learn lessons from catastrophes, it's that state and local governments are very careful about where they make their rebudgeting adjustments. After 9/11, even for the next couple of years, as we were in the dot-com bust at that point, cities and many local governments increased public safety spending, even as their revenues were declining. I think the lesson from that is whatever the catalyst was, in this case, a public health crisis, you can expect public health expenditures. In fact, most counties and states have already said they're going to spend more on public health than they did before. Those expenditures are going to increase. So the question is, what's going to get crowded out at the end? Would it be K-12 spending? And is Warren just mentioned in Brookings, in Colorado, that there was a 10% decline to K-12. Could it have been worse or could it have been better, depending on what the public health demands are in the state or in any state? Same thing with counties and other local governments. Is it public health spending? Probably public safety spending. Although when the defund police movement, it may reinvent itself as another kind of expenditure activity, but essentially for the purposes of public safety. So those demands that are coming from the taxpayer and the residents are going to come up against some limit. And is it going to be the K-12 support or less, or are there other discretionary parts, what states might and cities might consider to be discretionary parts, that they will start making some adjustments? I think that is at least unknown at this point, and a lot of conversations around that.
Fitzroy, what has UC done in terms of the school budgets?
So, there weren't major cuts. In fact, there might have been some increases. So one of the things that, when the mayor presented the budget, we were able to do, I think you mentioned at the start, at least Mike mentioned that we started with record level of, reserves, and we were able to not cut as much as we had hoped on the areas. I know we're going to get into this later, but it was more pay freezes and so on that we started with. But for some of the key priorities was housing and education. And so they were able to make some modest increase in education in anticipation, as you say, that, going into the next school year, it's going to be very difficult and they're going to be extra spending that were not anticipated before COVID. So there has not been actual cutbacks in education, at least not yet. When we see the next forecast, that could happen. But for now, given where we are and with the reserve we have had, we were able to make investment in housing and education. And in particular, they're still working on the plan of what K-12 will look like going into the fall. And I think this week there should be an announcement. So, many school districts are doing that, just trying to figure out what the school look like. But the anticipation is that it will involve extra spending and there's some provision made for that as they go forward.
And so I guess one implication, you sort of said it now, is if there's a second wave and a W-shaped recession where we go back down again, then it's going to be much harder to adapt to because kind of some of these one-time things like your rainy day funds and maybe some one-time tricks might be gone. And is that correct?
No, that is correct. And I know we're actually in the my office does the revenue forecast and, every day we're getting call of what it's going to look like in August because they're trying to make contingency plans about what do we do if it's actually, one of the difficulty in making forecasts, of course, is this is not just all economic. It's tied up with what action you're taking to control the virus. And that in turn depends on what happens in terms of the infection rates. And that's one of the things we're grappling with because we'll probably not know about a second wave until we're in the fall. And so for now, we're looking strictly at the economics of it. And so if there is actually a second wave or the revenue is lowered, because right now we had made our forecasts based on what we believe to be, the pace of opening. And we're falling behind that just because if you look around, people are slowing down the reopening just based on what's happening around the country. And so we anticipate that will have an effect on our revenue forecast going forward.
And Louise, if I may, even without a W, even without a second wave, we're looking at a multi-year budget impact. And if there's anything we've learned from the past two recessions is they don't hit one or two budget cycles, they hit four or five, because you're climbing back. You have deferred expenses that you need to make up. And it's just a very slow climb back. I think Michael made this comment in the beginning. So we're even without a W, we've only forecast out through fiscal 22, but planning wise, we need to be looking at least a 4-year revenue decline. And it looks quite severe without additional federal support.
So one thing I just want to add to that. So one of the requirements as a result of our Home Rule Act is that we are required to do a 4-year budget. And so our forecasts are always 4 years out. And as Lauren says, we're looking at revenue for the entire period of our financial plan. We're looking at lower revenues relative to where we were pre-COVID.
So given that, how do cities and states address their reserve policies and decide how much to use right away and how much to preserve for the W or they'll just even without that, the 3 years from now? Mike, do you want to jump in on that?
Sure. Cities and states have been known to revise their reserve policies anytime there's a crisis like this. So that's going to be flexible in the end. It depends on what the state considers to be a safety margin. I know they have targets, but if you fall too far below the target, you want to hold on to that and make adjustments elsewhere. And that's going to be up to state and local governments to decide what that's going to be. But with revenues coming in, if they don't come in quickly, they are going to have to address that problem, to hold in their reserves. But there are other adjustments that they'll make at the same time. And I think that was the point that both Lauren and Fitzroy were making, is that there are rebudgeting adjustments throughout the year. The legislature doesn't just quit or city council go home after they pass the budget.
So what about the ability to use debt to help through this crisis? I mean, we always hear about state and local balance budget requirements. You know, can cities borrow more easily? Can states get around them? How much will debt play a role in trying to get through this crisis? Lauren, you want to start?
Sure. So for Colorado, extending debt is not an easy option. We are restricted by our constitution from issuing debt without going to a vote of the people. We do have some certificates of participation, which are some asset-backed issuances. And we, even with those, we're finding that our operating funds are so tight, the service on those are difficult to make, and we've had to shift it out of the general fund and into our highway fund. So it's eating away at what's available just for regular maintenance. So, and you had given us a heads up about this question, and I would give some thought to, why is it? It's a great time to borrow. Rates are low. And I think it's when you look, as Fitzroy said, you're looking at a 4 or 5 year window of the budget being so tight that even an increased expense for debt service could feel really, a high burden to a state budget, even if you are able to borrow with the will of the people. And in addition, if you're thinking about just generally shrinking as a community, thinking about shrinking the budget, doing more with less, big campaigns about going out and spending a lot, sort of there's a disconnect there. So those are a couple thoughts on what's impacting in Colorado and other states.
For the district, for a long time, they've had really high debt, and several, maybe about a decade ago, the policymakers came together and wanted to control the increase in that debt. So there's a 12% cap and 12% of expenditure that we spend on debt service. And so all of the all of that has been used up more or less in terms of capital and maintenance, the capital budget. And so there's no room in terms of borrowing just to get through the operating and the operating side. And in any case, because of our requirement that we have a 4-year budget and financial plan, it's hard to do a lot of one-time deals. If you make a reduction, the financial plan has to be balanced over 4 years. So we'll have to show where you'd make the cuts. So there, the practice has been only to use borrowing for capital expenditures.
The short-term borrowing for operating can be done if you're waiting for a tax source. So you can issue short-term notes like that. But the long-term debt, I can't imagine, is going to increase too much, even though logic might dictate that the interest rate is. But the interest rate, the borrowing rate has been so low for so long that we could have expected a lot more to have been invested in infrastructure over the last decade, except I think, as Lauren points out, you still have the debt retirement issue that you have to work into your budget. And is that going to take away from K-12 spending or other kinds of programs? And apparently, state and local governments aren't willing to act in a countercyclical manner the way the federal government can. And instead of borrowing more during the Great Recession or borrowing more right now to rebuild whatever needs to be done on the infrastructure side, the capital budget tends to be a lot more responsive to, in a pro-cyclical manner, responsive to the changes in the economy. And in part, I suspect, is that what local state and local governments want to do is maintain service delivery at some particular level. And if they continue to transfer cash from their collections to the capital side rather than to the operating side, that may be a choice they don't want to make. So you end up transferring cash that would have gone to the capital budget back into the operating budget. And you actually see capital spending declining in some cases, not because there's not as much capital from the bond market, but rather because there's not as much capital from cash transfers from the state.
I was muted. So actually, we had a question on an email that you sort of mentioned. So this delay of the federal tax deadline, it seems like one of those short-term cash flow issues, although perhaps there's some worry that people actually won't be able to make their final payments, sort of like the property tax delinquencies. So is that something that most cities or states, well, mostly states, I suppose, for income tax, just borrowed for that cash flow delay? Or is that something that they actually cut spending to try to meet in the fiscal year?
I guess I can start with that, because that was something, as we were going into the forecast, that we worried about a lot. As our CFO said, in this period, cash is king, because we have to. One of the things, I mean, and you probably all know, because we're still a creature of the Congress, and one of the things is imposed that we couldn't. If one of the, we have had a, you know, way back in the late 90s, you probably know, we had a control board, and when the control board left, it was only dormant, and one of the requirements that if we can't pay our bills, if we run out of cash, then, you know, that would be one reason for a return of a control board. So we have guarded the cash, you know, we were lucky coming out of 2000 that we had a lot of cash reserve. But one of the things that we had to do, and our treasurer did a lot of financial analysis just to see where we would be on cash. And so one of the things we were looking at was whether, you know, given the low interest rates now, whether we should just borrow, as Mike mentioned, more tax anticipation notes. And we actually took out that line of credit. We were able to do that just in case. We believe that given all the cash reserve, we'll be able to make it true. But one consideration was, of course, the deferral of income tax payments. And locally, we did some for the hotels because they were in so much trouble. We deferred their real property tax payments in March as well. So, you know, one of the things we're nervous about, not having able to see the final payments for so long is what happens when we start to look at those figures. But for sure, in terms of the cash flow, we were really worried about what the deferral would do to that. But given where we were at the end of the year and looking at the analysis, we think we will make it through.
Lauren?
Yes, we're squeaking by on the cash side. We did implement a sequestration in April, given where it looked how fast we were burning through our reserves. So that was a significant action that we took rapidly to try and rein in some spending before the end of the fiscal year.
Wait, sorry, so just like across the board cuts in spending? Or what?
Not across the board. We were strategic. We had had our department sort of at the ready to, you know, be working on where there might be saving or spending they could forego. And so we asked them very quickly, give them a target and a financial target, and they were able to meet it. And we issued an executive order to sequester the funds. But we are looking very anxiously at the July data because we increased our allowance for delinquencies and bankruptcies, and seeing what actually comes in the door with the extended tax deadline, we're all waiting with bated breath.
And what about considering not sort of reducing pension contributions? Is that a non-starter for most places? Is that something that's on the table? And that's a city and a, yeah. So Mike, go ahead. I see you nodding.
I guess I can say, I hope not. I think this is one of those, as the mayor of Oakland, your previous panel just said, is that her first decision is always what's in the long-term best interest of Oakland as the mayor. And I think cities and states have to do the same thing. What's in the long best interest of the city and the state. And that might be the easiest in, but it can become habitual after a while. And I'm in one of those states where we are suffering from having that can kick down the road so far that to not make pension contributions now would be probably the worst thing to do.
And politically, how would that just be viewed as a...
Politically, I think politically in this state, it may be a way through in the short term, but I don't think they're seriously considering. I think that has played itself out so well over so many decades now that I don't think that card's going to be played now as a political card.
I just wanted to add that in the district, I mean, I mentioned coming out of that financial crisis, there was a restructuring and the federal government took over a lot of the pensions. And so the district has been, and then all the benefits that they have taken on, we have been able, the OPEB funding, that has been fully funded for a number of years now. In fact, overfunded over 100%. So luckily for the district, that has not been a problem. And one of the things that we've done is to keep funding one of the priorities in the mayor's budget was to keep funding those at the level we are, the OPEB, the ones that are still on our books for firefighters and teachers and so on. So right now it's fully funded, and that's one thing they've tried not to touch again for political reasons, as you mentioned. So, you know, we have not dipped into any pension funds right now.
So there's a question that I probably should have asked, but we get from one of our viewers, which is one thing we have not mentioned, although I think somebody, Mike, might have mentioned. No, Fitzroy, you mentioned a little bit. So when we think about budget balance requirements, we don't, that UI claims don't count against those. So are UI claims something that states are just happy to borrow for and don't worry about? Or does the fact that the claims are so high and that means there's pressure down the road actually affect the other decisions about what to spend? Lauren?
Yeah, I'd say it's somewhere in between. It, because we are able to access borrowing at a, you know, at a low rate for those expenses, it is helping. And Colorado didn't have the reserves we needed in our UI claim fund. I haven't looked at that as a national analysis. I'd be interested to know. But I think we were far short of what we needed, and that will be significant. But I'll tell you, we're so grateful right now for every dollar spent on UI, both what the state's spending and what the federal government has sent. The extra $600 a week is making a huge difference in consumer spending, and it's keeping the economy going. And we're, again, this is another thing, late July, August, we're going to be looking at the data very carefully to see what's happening with consumer. If that extra payment turns off and is not extended, will we be... we'll be watching what happens to consumer confidence, and then we'll very quickly be looking at this consumer spending data to see how quickly that impacts behavior.
That's interesting. So I was going to go to my last question, which is what aid do you need from the federal government? And I was sort of thinking about aid to state and local governments. As you mentioned, that's not the only thing that matters. So what are you, I'll let each of you quickly respond. We have, 5 minutes. So what are you looking for from the federal government? What do you think they should be doing? Why don't you start, Fitzroy?
So I will start, let's say, we would welcome additional federal aid. And this time around, to be welcome being treated as a state rather than like a territory, because the last time we got less than most other states because they were categorizing us as a territory rather than a state. And so we actually got less. And even though it has been very helpful in helping to balance the budget, we would welcome, very much welcome more federal aid, and this time treating the district more like a state.
Yeah, I think most state and local governments have already found out, is that they're going to be, it's going to be a rolling hit, as those that are highly reliant on the sales and income taxes are already getting the hit. They'll maybe pick up a little bit sooner if the economy picks up. But if we're going through, as you mentioned, Louisa, then they're going to lose it again. There's only one other source that can borrow for operating purposes, and that's the federal government, and that can provide the kind of support that allows for states and metro areas in particular to understand that they are very, very diverse and heterogeneous. They're not all exactly the same. Some communities rely on a property tax, middle upper income, and they're able to work from home, are certainly not getting hit as hard as other communities that are unlike that. So the federal aid needs to distinguish among the needs of those state and local governments, number one. Number two, this has nothing to do with your question to Louise, but a plug that this is the time for state and local governments to seriously rethink their fiscal architecture, what they have created, their fiscal levers on the economy that they're drawing resources from. It's a critical time to rethink this rather than doing some changes around the edge of what already exists. Thank you.
Never let a good crisis go to waste. Yeah. I like that. Indeed, we are looking to do some restructuring in Colorado and try to reduce our spend so we'll have more available for investment. But there's just the basic math here where there for the next at least 3 years we're going to be in a really difficult situation without additional federal aid. So NGA and NASBO have called on Congress to provide an additional $500 billion in state aid some other additional pieces around the FMAP, the Medicaid match, and some education spending as well. And then, as I mentioned before, it's in terms not directly to the state, but to beneficiaries, we're seeing that the UI enhanced benefit is having a tremendous effect on our economy. And we really hope that Congress will consider extending that.
Great. Well, with that, I think our time is up. I really would like to thank all of you for what I think was an interesting and informative session. Good luck. I know you have very tough jobs, at least two of you in government, figuring out how to handle all this. So thank you for taking your time out of that and coming to talk to us. So that's the end of this session. We are heading right into another panel, which is the COVID-19 Municipal Bond Market Response and Outlook, which will be moderated by Rich Reifel. So stay tuned through a brief transition, and Rich will bring it up from there. And thank you all again. It's fun.
Thank you, Louise.
Bye.
Thank you.
Okay. get our next panel started. Good segue from that panel we just heard into this. I think that gave us a good foundation for this. So thank you all for attending our panel, COVID-19 Municipal Bond Market Response and Outlook. This session, we're going to be looking at the state of the municipal bond markets during the early days of the pandemic, the effects of various policy responses on the market, and the outlook for the market moving forward. And our aim in this panel is to inform market participants on what's in store for them moving forward and inform future policy responses by both issuers and regulators. I'm Rich Reifel, a professor of finance practice at Washington University in St. Louis, and one of the co-chairs and co-founders of this, our ninth conference here at Brookings. I'm joined by an impressive panel of experts today, so thank you, panelists, for joining us. Their full bios are posted on the conference website, but briefly, they are, and maybe you all can give a wave to the camera, Sarah Snyder. Sarah has 15 years of public finance banking experience and is currently a managing director at Ramirez. She focuses her practice on origination, structuring, and execution of municipal debt across various sectors, including water and sewer, airports, transportation, and general infrastructure. And Sarah also is a proud graduate of the Olin School of Business at Washington University, one of the presenters of this conference. Our second panelist, Patrick Brett. Patrick is a managing director and head of Citi's Municipal Debt Capital Markets and a member of the board of directors of the MSRB. Patrick has been with Citi for 20 years and has experience both in the U.S. and globally, which will come up in our conversation today. Gary Hall. Gary Hall is a partner and the head of infrastructure and public finance at Siebert Williams Shank and a partner at American III Partners, an infrastructure private equity fund. He's the immediate past chair of the MSRB. And last but not least, Kent Heitschut. Kent is a longtime public finance banker with a lot of experience in the markets, working and advising issuers. And recently, he was hired by the Federal Reserve Board to help it analyze and craft its response to the municipal market dislocations that occurred in March. So again, thank you, panelists. A couple of brief housekeeping notes. You've heard from the other moderators that viewers can submit questions for us by emailing events@brookings.edu or by joining the conversation on Twitter using hashtag MuniFinance. And a quick reminder that at the end of this panel, there'll be a short break, and then we'll reconvene at 3:45 Eastern time with two concurrent breakout sessions not hosted on this page, this link that you're on now, but rather by Zoom webinar. So we'll hope you'll join one of those two breakouts. And you should have an email if you registered from Brookings with the details on all of that, or you can email Stephanie Sensula at brookings.edu at ssensula@brookings.edu if you have any trouble. So let's get started. And I've in prepping our panel, I've asked each panelist to be prepared to answer each question. So a reminder, the panelists to be brief, and I'll remind you the order that we're going to ask you to answer these questions, because we tried to mix it up a bit. So the first question that I want you all to address, please, is just give the audience a sense for the condition of the muni market in March. What was happening as this shutdown was happening in the kind of early days of the pandemic in terms of flows and liquidity and price discovery? And we'll start with Sarah, please. Sarah, you're muted.
I'm unmuted now. Apologies. Okay. So you can hear me? We're good? Okay. So, it's amazing to think that this was 4 months ago. And while many of us experienced this firsthand and probably don't necessarily want to relive it again, I'll just give, a few points of what happened in kind of the first 2 weeks of March just to set the stage, and then pass it on to others to give more detail. But, looking back, it's really unreal that this all occurred within a 2-week period. So going into 2020, fundamentals were strong for munis, both in the market and from a credit perspective. Issuers had, you know, almost stopped talking about what happens if we go into a recession, but the vast majority were more prepared than they were in 2008, stronger reserves, but nobody really could have predicted the quick turnaround that was ahead of us. So, at the end of February, MMD had hit all-time lows when we didn't think that that was possible again. The stock market saw large swings as, COVID was at fever pitch and causing investor participation to vary and, the storm to start brewing. So, the week ended March 6th represented the inflection point for our market. We had extreme volatility with 2,000-point swings in the Dow. On March 3rd, the Fed Reserve delivered an emergency 50-basis-point cut to the Fed funds rate. There was a flight to quality where treasuries came down significantly. The 10-year treasury lowered by about 70 basis points over a two-week period. And we ended up with ratios that were over 200% for munis versus treasuries, which we hadn't seen since 2008. And then I think, most importantly for our market was that after 60 consecutive weeks of inflows, there was a panic from investors. Mutual funds began what we would see as 6 weeks of outflows, causing a lack of buyers as accounts were trying to raise cash. So we then, going into the second week of this, that all happened in within a one-week span. Going into the second week, the oil, price war began. And by Wednesday, March 11th, the municipal market decoupled from the U.S. Treasury market. The secondary market was in a free-for-all, and the primary market came to a halt. So nearly all deals were pulled. So as a banker, it was pretty much, full standstill and just providing as much information to our clients as possible. Within that week, 10-year MMD increased by 83 basis points within 1 week. And forget the fact that we had all, as market participants, been used to working side by side. And in this, panic mode, we all then had to go into quarantine. So I'll stop there and let others kind of weigh in. But that kind of, I think, sets the stage for where March began.
All right. Thanks, Sarah. Patrick, you're up.
Sure. Thanks, Rich. Thanks, Sarah, for setting the stage. That was really comprehensive. I mean, just to add my own thoughts. I mean, I have been doing this for about 20 years, and I would say I think what was different about March as compared to the financial crisis, I think, was both the speed of the move as well as the violence of it. I mean, the amplitude of the move Sarah mentioned. I mean, it came on so quickly. Sarah mentioned the Fed acting at the beginning of March, and then kind of almost only a week or two later, we were seeing moves in municipals that we really hadn't seen relative to treasuries since the Great Depression. If you think of the financial crisis, actually came on a lot more slowly. It was March of 08 that Bear Stearns had issues, and then Lehman Brothers was in September of 08, and it wasn't until March of 09 that the equity market really bottomed out. So that one really was a slower burn. I think what was positive, and I'm sure we'll talk about this more, the policy response was also much quicker this time around. Not quite as quick in municipals as some of the other assets, but also unprecedented as compared to what happened in the financial crisis. I think in terms of the moves, I was on the sales and trading side for the financial crisis. And this was, we didn't have the same sort of forced delevering that we had of hedge funds back in the financial crisis. But this was, as Sarah said, it was massive redemptions from the mutual funds that were just overwhelming any demand, natural demand in the market. So we went from kind of negative 20 spread to treasuries for long municipals to positive 200 spread. You could buy treasury-backed municipals. I studied finance 20 or 25 years ago. You're not supposed to have these sort of pure arbitrages, but you could buy treasury-backed municipals that in 3 years at a 3% at a time when three-year treasuries were close to zero. So there were definitely, the municipal market was going haywire in March, to sum it up in a word.
Thank you for that, Gary.
Well, I had more hair then, that's for sure. And now I know Kent was a little concerned. This is water, Kent. It wasn't then in March. It was really crazy. Conversely, we saw a record issues in the corporate market, over close to $207 billion in corporate, which is a record month for them. I would say two anecdotes for me sort of stood out is that first I saw a sizable number of issuers who historically go competitive, decided to go negotiating. I mean, and we had, it ran to rank, even from the State Public Works Board in California to small school districts in Portland, to the Virginia Public Building Authority, all decided to access the market via negotiated mode vis-a-vis competitive. They wanted to be able to time the market. They wanted to be able to have flexibility on structures to meet investor demand. And overall, you know, I can't empirically show what the quantitative difference was, but from the satisfactory, just anecdotal standpoint, it seems like issuers were happy that they made that decision. I have one case study for my for myself that stood out, is that I had my first deal ever in my career that was didn't get completed after starting. We started a deal, it was an A-rated credit for issue from a specialty state, which typically draws peak demand, at least in, with the market technicals we had in years past. It wasn't an essential service credit, which stood out for investors, but essentially we could only get 40% of the deal subscribed. And even that 40% that was subscribed was thinly subscribed, meaning if we had tried to underwrite the remaining 60%, those investors would have left because they wanted company. And so ultimately the issuer decided to pull the deal, and the deal is still on the shelf today. So I think that speaks volume as to sort of the turbulence that we incurred in that time.
Thank you. And Kent?
Yeah, I endorse Sarah's comments about 4 months seems a long time ago. I thought I'd share my day on March 20th with the audience. Unlike the three experts that you've got on the panel, I was out of the muni market, sitting at home, enjoying myself, not worrying about my clients' problems like Gary was. And I got a phone call from an official at the Fed that I didn't know, I knew of, and she had gotten my name from a common friend. And she said, what's going on in the muni market? And I thought I'd share with you what I told her on that day. So this was Friday the 20th. And what I said was, clearly mutual funds are going through an unprecedented massive selling of securities to meet the redemptions of their clients. But as prices of fixed rate bonds were plummeting, they were turning to their VRDB portfolios, which they have the right, the contractual right, to put back to broker dealers at par. So rather than selling at a loss, they can sell at par. In turn, broker dealer sheet balance sheets had ballooned to reportedly as much as 25 billion of VRDBs, which forced resets sharply higher. So we were at a period on Friday where daily resets were approaching double digits at the same time that treasury yields were appropriately falling towards Fed monetary policy of zero. So this had two immediate effects. First of all, issuers who had to pay these higher rates were, that was compounding their fiscal stress that they were beginning to beginning to feel the effects of. And then secondly, broker-dealer balance sheets and the losses from these securities were compounding the conditions in the fixed-rate markets. And then the third factor, all around this VRDB product, which is one-third the size of what was back in 2008, as Patrick was referencing, the supply-demand dislocation within that market was causing mutual fund TOB programs to be turned upside down. So the normal positive spread between the underlying fixed rate bonds and the synthetic VRDBs had turned negative. This caused those programs in part to begin to be unwound, or at least the fear that they would. And in that situation, the broker dealer is basically in the position of having to sell those fixed rate, those underlying fixed rate bonds at any price, which really can contributed to further downward pressure on fixed rate bonds. So I thought that the VRDB market in particular was very, very problematic at the end of that week, March 20th. And that's the message I communicated.
Great. Thanks for that. Ordinarily, I think of when you have this much experience together talking about something, ordinarily I would expect you would say, well, you know, I remember the last time something like this happened, and here's the way it was, and here's how we recovered and all of that. And what I'm hearing is all the last times together did not approximate this time. And so that leads me to this next question of whether this recovery and the sort of refunctioning and reordering of the municipal market is like anything that you've seen in the past, and maybe how it's different. And that gets me to this question. So it's a lot's changed since March, and the market is normalized quite a bit, but could you each give us a perspective for what's changed in terms of investor base, liquidity, issuance, et cetera? And specifically, and we do have a question from the audience about this, if we could talk about the role of the MLF in that. And Kent, you're actually leading us off, so it's an appropriate segue. If you could talk about where we are in the market and what you're seeing there. And again, from the perspective perhaps of the Fed and the MLF.
Yeah, well, given the time constraint, I'll leave the other three to talk about where we are now and maybe pick up the story where I just left off and not turn immediately to the MLF, but to turn to something that's probably more technical and not as well appreciated in outside the muni market is the money market liquidity facility, which had already been rolled out the week of the 16th, but did not include VRDBs because it was limited to maturities of 12 months. Well, we all know that VRDBs act like short-term securities. They have a nominal long-term maturity that is backed by a liquidity facility of a bank or self-liquidity. So the Fed over the weekend concluded that they needed to address this VRDB program, the problem that I described, by simply opening up the MMLF on Monday morning, the 23rd, to VRDBs. So they made a very simple change and just said that the 12-month, they defined the 12-month maturity to include VRDBs that had a put of less than 12 months. That had an amazingly immediate impact on the marketplace. And what I think is very interesting is that we never got very much take up into the MMLF of municipal securities. It's certainly less than a billion. I think it may be 500 million at this point, but it's trivial in the overall $160 billion VRDB market. But the mere existence of the facility had a calming effect on the marketplace. Money market funds knew they could sell those securities. Broker dealers knew they had an outlet for them. And rates began to immediately fall to where today they're about 10 basis points. They had gotten as high as 9 that week before. I joined the Fed several days later. Our mandate was to take a look at a market that the Fed had never in its over 100 years of history intervened in. We did not yet have the CARES Act, but we had what we call our Section 13(3) authority to intervene in markets in unusual and exigent circumstances. And that's what we immediately began to focus on. 2.5 weeks later, we did roll out the $500 billion MLF program. It's important to remember it was announced on the same day as in total $2.3 trillion of federal facilities between the Treasury and Fed across many markets. So the muni market was only one of those markets. The goal, the objective, the policy objective of the MLF was to first address liquidity in the government sector. The most important thing was to make sure that if the markets weren't functioning properly, that state and local governments knew they had a source to keep their governments running, to keep vital services flowing to their citizens. And so the first objective was to make sure that issuers knew they had a source of capital for that purpose. The corollary to that, but equally important, was the view that by assuring that state and local governments had access to liquidity, that that would be supportive of the broader and longer term fixed rate muni market, because the market would know that the debtors, the issuers in the marketplace, had access to such short term liquidity, and they would continue to function and be able to pay their debts in the interim while the market and the economy overcame the COVID crisis. So those were the two policy objectives. People ask about why weren't there longer maturities? why weren't certain entities eligible? We were taking our first step into the muni market with 40,000 issuers and maturities. 80% of the market is a long only market of 10 years or longer. We felt this is the best way to have an immediate impact to get something up and operating. People were also frustrated that it took us as long as it did to actually make it operational. I can tell you I learned a lot in those 6 weeks, and I thought we did something extraordinarily fast given what the issues were. Almost all the other facilities that the Fed rolled out sooner had actually been tried and tested back in the financial crisis. So it was on the shelf. They just had to roll it out. So in any case, I'll turn the story over to the other participants, but in short order, the market rallied to the point where, thank goodness, state and local governments have access to not only liquidity, but they have access to long-term financing. We have major issuers borrowing at less than 50 basis points for liquidity and certainly less than 2.5% for long-term capital. The market is open. It's different. There's important differences and things we need to talk about. But in terms of the emergency, we believe the Fed contributed not only with these two facilities, but with the broader monetary policy of supporting the quick recovery of the municipal market.
Thanks, Kent. Well, Patrick, your firm is one of the larger underwriters in the market, and you had some pretty significant issuers back in the market with new issuance early. Can you comment on kind of where we stand now in terms of the market and what you're seeing?
Sure. Yeah, and I think a lot has changed in terms of investors' liquidity and issuance, to take on the three parts of your question. I mean, I think in terms of investors that have changed, I think Kent covered it. The biggest investor that's changed is the Fed. I think the signaling effect, as Kent was alluding to, has been really powerful. I mean, I think the Fed really crossed the Rubicon with the MMLF, which Kent mentioned, which didn't get as much attention, but that was the first time the Fed, to my knowledge, really was directly buying municipals. They didn't in the financial crisis. They've had the power since the Federal Reserve Act was created. To my knowledge, it's been dormant. In Section 14, they can buy up to 6 months, but they haven't done so. So I think the MMLF was the first step. And then the CARES Act, actually, just the knowledge that the Fed was going to be armed to be able to come into the market, I think, even as the CARES Act was coming together, that's when the market, that weekend of, I guess, heading into the week of March 23rd, that was when the market really started to recover, just knowing that the Fed was going to be armed with this power. Of course, I think some people expected the Fed to do a little more to become a bigger investor, the same way they have in the corporate market, maybe rolling out secondary and primary facilities. They haven't done all that. But I think the signaling effect of the Fed as an investor has been quite powerful through the MLF and then also through the potential of additional facilities, which Chair Powell mentioned. In terms of other investors, I mean, banks have become a lot more involved in the market, three or four times as active, I think, by the flows we're seeing in our new issue order books and the secondary relative to pre-COVID. I think that's the relative value between munis and treasuries and swaps. Foreign investors, we've seen a lot more active. The biggest driver there is probably the currency swap moves. The dollar relative to other currencies has made some of those trades come back in the money. We've seen alternative investors get a lot more involved, and that really accelerated as the municipal markets recovery kind of lagged other markets. Other markets that are the beneficiaries, frankly, of more direct Fed buying and Fed facilities. So we started to see alternative investors looking for value. In terms of liquidity, I mean, if liquidity got horrendous in March. The bid-ask spreads widened out dramatically. I mean, they've come back, but not all the way back to where they were pre-COVID. Dealer balance sheets have shrunk by at least half, I think, probably from the Fed actually keeps those numbers, I think, from $14 billion down to $7 billion. So there's a smaller amount of liquidity on dealer balance sheets at this point, which doesn't necessarily bode well if we have another downdraft. And just in terms of issuance, I mean, for a period of time, you couldn't sell any sort of COVID sensitive sector, and kind of one by one, everything that seemed only a few months ago like we wouldn't be able to sell this year, we've been able to sell, even like sensitive transportation sectors and things like that. About the only sectors that I don't think we have seen, the other panelists can correct me if I'm wrong, but I think hotels and convention centers, credit analysts are still kind of trying to work through what this means for those. So we haven't seen those come fully back. I would also say, even for the ones that have come back, investors are really digging into credits. There's been a renaissance of credit, like deep credit analysis on some of these. And it is the same way we saw right after the financial crisis, where the uptake on one-on-one calls and the demand from investors for the very latest information about traffic and revenues and things like that is quite high at the moment, as investors are trying to discern what this all means.
Right. Thank you. And Gary, what are you seeing in your corner of the market?
You know, the only thing I would add to what Patrick mentioned is the, you know, SMAs are back. You know, we had a precipitous ride in the first 5 years of MMD going up 53 basis points early in March. You didn't see much SMA, most of them trying to get their money out of funds so they can have cash in order to weather the storm. Bond ETFs are back, and they're playing well, and even insurance companies. Now, the other thing that we started to see a little bit more receptivity to shorter calls. You know, it was reflexively, you had a 10-year par call, and that was sort of the nature of the beast. But investors are starting to be a little bit more receptive toward credit enhancement. Bond insurance is back. Not in the same sort of palpable way we saw pre-economic downturn in 2008, but more issuers are willingly contemplated after feeling burned after the last go-round. And more investors are asking for that comfort. So those are probably the only thing I would add. And then we should note that volume is up. Year to year, we are about 191 billion, and that's 14% over where we were year over year last year. So there is a tremendous amount of stability back in the municipal market.
Thank you. And Sarah, to you, anything the others missed?
I would just reiterate to our issuer clients that it really is kind of the perfect market for municipals to come to market right now. I mean, we're seeing interest rates again near historical lows, and you know, with demand exceeding supply, you know, we're just seeing strong participation on all credits. There's no longer the haves and have-nots. It's you know, for the most part, most transactions are getting done, and whether the Fed meant to or not, you know, we're seeing munis being very attractive compared to corporates. And so I think that's helping drive down spreads and overall attractiveness for our market. So I think it's a great time for it. If issuers are able to come, depending on where their revenues are, you know, it is a good time for them to be in the market.
Great. Thank you for that. So we had a lot of disruption in March. We've recovered, and as to a large degree, the market is functioning. As we heard in the last panel, issuers face a lot of challenges on the revenue side. Some have already adjusted to that. Others are wondering when the next shoe might drop. They certainly have been spending a lot of money responding to various COVID issues. So, if I could ask you all to comment on how do you think that's going to play out in the market moving forward? We heard a little bit about potential, you know, deficit funding and things like that, and maybe some transactions that might be able to help on that score. How do you see the market changing over the next year, specifically with respect to things like disclosure? Yeah, we heard someone reference marketing and digging in and bond insurance, et cetera. So disclosure and credit issues, volumes, sale methodology, that's a particular favorite of mine to look at, whether we might see more negotiated volume, notwithstanding the comment that was made earlier. And then if you could also make some comments on potential new rules on refundings, which were changed a couple of years ago with the Tax Act, and the role of taxable debt. So I know I threw a lot out at you there. But if I could ask Gary maybe to start on what are you looking for in the next year or so?
I don't know if it was the year I spent as MSRB chair, but I focus a lot on disclosure. And while, you know, the first portion of the dislocation we saw during this pandemic was primarily a liquidity crisis, I think the credit differentiation is here to stay. And I think as we saw in the post-2008 downturn, where buy-side credit analysis will sizably uptick, we're going to see that more, even on steroids, say it differently. You want to see varied level of pricing performance with credits of the same rating based on investors' perceived ability to buy and the issuer's ability to sell credit stories. So if you think about major differentiation points, being able to be sure that you have a strong record for meeting your continued disclosure obligations, having the willingness, as Patrick mentioned, to engage investors during the deal process. But I would also add, even not in the deal process, to get real-time information when necessary. Having timeliness, annual financial statements, but not only just having timely on an annual financial statement, having accessible interim financial statements, and maybe taking advantage of some of the things that MSRB have with, you know, customized IMA pages so investors can get real-time information. Demonstrating the political will to make tough decisions, the subjective evaluation of credit is going to be substantial, and not just the tough decisions on budget cuts and server delivery suspensions or relief from onerous bargaining agreements, rainy day funds, and all that sort of stuff, but how are you dealing with COVID? Are you making those tough decisions to close down government responsibly? And investors will take a look at that. As for policy changes, I'm going to leave a lot of this for Ken and Patrick to speak to. You know, the one thing that I am most interested in seeing come to fruition quickly is the reinstatement of advanced refundings for tax-exempt debt. We have bicameral, a bipartisan support for this, and I never thought this would happen given the scrutiny on scoring from the House and Ways and Means Committee, but it seems like that's a reality. And if that happens, that's going to give a huge feather in the cap to a lot of our issuers looking to extract savings and alternative deal payments.
Kent, you're up next if you want to pick it up there.
Sure. Well, I would say we're pleased with the recovery of the market. We are remaining vigilant, and we don't think we're necessarily out of the woods. I would say that with regard to COVID and the public health challenges that that we face, how that translates into muni credits. I think the fiscal issues that are challenging state and local governments and issuers has only just begun. We're at the beginning of a new fiscal year. There's always a lag in terms of revenues, whether they're increases or losses, and this time they're going to be losses. And I think there's a lot of budgets that are being balanced on the hope of federal aid coming. And so I don't think we're out of the woods in terms of muni credit. And again, I hope we don't see something like March, but the market, our market is 70% retail. It's a market that depends very, very heavily on one buyer for the long end. And that's where, as I said before, 80% of the securities are sold to. So we remain vigilant about the municipal market, and our view is the MLF is available at least through the end of the year, and it's designed to be a backstop. But as Patrick helpfully pointed out, our chair has consistently messaged that the MLF is not necessarily constitute all of our powers, and we remain vigilant. And my job and our team's job is to continue to monitor the market, and if additional intervention is required, the Fed's prepared to consider it. In terms of policy, again, our chair has been very clear that, and I think this is a frustration in the muni market, that folks think that monetary policy can solve all these problems, and clearly it cannot. Our job is to make sure that the markets are functioning and people have access to capital, not necessarily at zero interest rates, not to solve the huge lost revenue problem that our state and local governments are and will continue to be facing for some time. So we think monetary policy has to work hand in hand with fiscal policy. And lastly, I just comment about the taxable market. This isn't a Fed position, but a personal Ken Haichu view that I'm a fan of BABS. I thought the taxable securities and the BABS program was tremendously helpful and important 10 years ago. I'd like to see that program, not just because of lower costs, but to better diversify our market. I think one of the positive elements here is we've introduced a lot more of alternative investor sector to the muni space, and we should seek to try to keep that sector engaged. You know, the new issuance, we shouldn't conclude that the market is strong because we've had this record issuance. I think there's been a 250% increase in taxables and a 5% decline in tax exempts year to date. I would also expect there to be very little new issuance, new money issuance, I should say, going forward because of the impact on muni credits. The first thing that is going to suffer is going to be reductions and rollbacks in capital programs. Most of the supply records we're seeing are because of advanced refundings being done in the taxable market and currents in the tax exempt. So far we've seen reductions in new money unless there were capital programs that were underway and had to be completed, a huge increase in taxables in large part in response to the advanced refunding restrictions. Also for universities to basically arbitrage their endowments. So I think taxables are an important element, but I'd like to see taxables for new money as much as they are for advanced refunding.
Thank you. And Patrick, what are you advising your clients at Citi to be mindful of moving forward?
I think to the first part of your question on credit issues, the technicals have undeniably become much better in the muni market. The market's wide open, as Sarah was saying. I think the fundamental picture still hasn't come into sharp focus. In some ways, we don't even know what the direct aid to state and local governments is going to be for a few more weeks. And even then state and local governments are going to have to figure out how they're going to balance the checkbook, figure out what kind of cuts are going to be made, what kind of taxes might be raised, what kind of deficit borrowings might happen. I think you saw the headline out of New Jersey, they at least approved the flexibility to borrow $10 billion for deficit financing. So I think issuers are going to be wrestling with that. And of course, that's going to have implications for credit going forward. And I think that is going to come into sharper focus as we move forward. In terms of issuance volumes, I think there's risk to the upside because of that first point where I think you could see really significant deficit borrowing. But it depends, as I said, how do issuers decide to balance that equation? And incidentally, the Fed doesn't want them to balance it by completely cutting expenses. And that's part of the reason why there's a very strong argument. And even Chair Powell was making the argument pretty strongly, even though he doesn't want to get involved in political issues. But I think he was making the argument that state and local government aid is important because you don't want. And I think one of the reasons why the 2008-2009 recession extended as long as it did was because of the layoffs of state and local government. So I think that's a big question mark for the market, which we'll find out in the next few weeks, probably before the August recess. In terms of negotiated competitive, I think we've already seen things swing more towards negotiated for the reasons that we discussed. Although this week we've seen the largest competitive week that we've seen. It's the largest week period that we've seen in supply. There's around 13 billion, biggest week we've had since COVID hit. 3 billion of that is competitive. So that's going to be a big test for the competitive market. That 3 billion is almost half of the total amount that dealers are holding in their books, according to the Fed numbers right now. So that's a large amount of competitive supply coming relative to the liquidity in the market. In terms of the Fed rules, I think that, I think there's going to be two bites at the apple here. There's going to be this phase four COVID relief bill, which actually could see, that state and local government aid is the big headline there, but there could be muni bond provisions that make their way in there, whether it's advanced refundings or a taxable bond option or private activity bond expansion. There's a chance of that. And then there's in September, again, there's potentially a highway bill extension, which could become a larger infrastructure bill. And that kind of recovery or stimulus type bill could also see some muni bond provisions added in. In terms of the taxable market, even without a taxable bond option being added back in, we've seen the highest issuance we've seen since 2010, the only full year of the BABS program. So yeah, that's certainly been good in terms of bringing in new investors. But it's also benefited those issuers who aren't even tapping the taxable market because it is pulling supply out of the tax exempt market. The same way that we saw a massive rally in tax exempt, a lowering of tax exempt yields in 2010 because it was pulling so much supply out. We're seeing that same kind of effect happen now where, as Kent mentioned, there's already a little bit less tax exempt supply. I think we're forecasting tax exempt supply is going to be down 20% by the end of the year. And remember all that money that's flowing into the mutual funds, that's flowing into tax exempt municipal mutual funds. So it's chasing fewer bonds. So that's all a positive in terms of the technicals for the market going forward.
Great. Thank you. And Sarah, you have the last word on this question.
I'll be quick, but I just would reiterate what Gary said in terms of disclosure and reminding people to think of the disclosure as it relates to the ESG, the environmental social governance, and how you are addressing those in your disclosure. It's important to provide what the financial impact of COVID is, but also how are you dealing with it? How are you applying your CARES money? How are you dealing with inequality in your area? And areas of poverty as it relates to COVID and the impact of a recession. And so I think giving that information to your investors will help get them more comfortable to hear with what you're doing. So we try to reiterate that with our issuer clients and expanding their disclosure into that space.
Great, thank you. We have just a couple of minutes before we go into our break. I'm gonna throw out one final question for anybody that cares to answer it. We've been talking mostly, obviously, about state and local finance here. I'm curious if you have any thoughts on issuance and issuers and challenges they may face in higher ed, healthcare, and special purpose bonds, and with a twist to that, also potentially what you're seeing in the high yield muni market. So not strictly governmental, but other markets that are more broadly kind of public finance, what might we expect in those markets? So who wants to take a crack at that? Patrick?
Briefly, I would just say in terms of the high yield market, I mean, we've seen even, I think we wouldn't have thought a few months ago that airline and airport bonds would be able to come readily and be very well received by investors. So we have seen that. There's good TSA data and things that investors can look at. And I think, people feel like those are pretty essential entities. But I think, for all the entities that you mentioned, convention centers, hotels, it's kind of turned credit analysts into armchair epidemiologists. And the big question is kind of when do we get a vaccine or when do we get a very effective treatment? And everyone's kind of trying to figure that out and what that means for the revenues of these entities. Because frankly, we're not really going to be past this until we have that.
Other thoughts on that, Ken?
Aren't technicals, Patrick, so important, even more so in the high yield? I mean, people think about high yield, and I don't think they appreciate how small of a market that is in munis. In corporates, high yield is unrated. In munis, high yield is BBB. Do we really just have a lot of money now chasing the same number of supply that we had 3 months ago?
There is, and I think you could make arguments. I mean, the simple arguments are sort of looking at some of the airline terminal bonds that have priced recently relative to their corporate peers. But I think if you dig like one level deeper, you see that you have gate security and you have some security that doesn't necessarily exist on the corporate side. So yeah, I agree. The technical picture is definitely helping. But I think the municipal high yield analysts are probably a little more sophisticated than they get credit for. So the technical picture is good. But yeah, leave it at that.
Any other thoughts on that? I'm personally just a little bit curious. I know there's been some higher ed issuance, but any thoughts on the higher ed issuance market? I think it's a big unknown how colleges are going to open, and I think they're all hoping to open and have reduced impact on revenues here in the fall. But any thoughts on how that plays out and how that impacts higher ed issuance?
I can quickly weigh in. I mean, I would say that most of the school, large schools have all come to market in the last, 2 months. A lot starting to come on using the corporate side as opposed to the muni side, but seem to have all been fairly well received by the market. And again, it's disclosure and letting people know what you're doing and putting your plans out there. But I think there's still a lot of unknowns about how they're going to open up in the fall, and they're all starting to release their plans over time. But again, it seems as though the reception on the transactions have been going well.
I still think it's untested though, because we've only seen sort of the well-endowed universities who have a tremendous amount of resources to weather the storm. We haven't seen down-tier sort of higher ed entities and what the play will be there. And the landscape for what's to come is so unknown that I think really having credibility in the forecast at this particular point would be very, very minimal. So I, as Kent mentioned before, the taxable sort of buoy we've seen in the higher ed market thus far has largely been driven on an arbitrage play with endowments, right? Now, there's flexibility that you have in issuing taxable debt that maybe that flexibility is now here to stay. Folks now realize they do have it, especially if technicals sort of remain the way they are. But I still think there's a huge unknown with the broader higher ed market to come.
Yeah. And your point, I know you mentioned earlier the insurance and, you know, like this week Drexel is coming and they've decided to use insurance. So there's, you know, we're seeing a different school that and how they're going about coming to market. So.
All right. I'm going to let that be the last word. Thank you again, panelists, and thanks to all that are listening on YouTube and Zoom and whatnot. A quick
reminder. Rich, you muted yourself. Rich, you're muted.
Oh, the host muted me. I guess that means I'm talking too long. In any event, we are headed to a break. We'll break till 3:45, and then we have individual breakout sessions. And for those that registered for the conference, you would have gotten an email that would direct you to the appropriate Zoom links to log into those breakouts. So again, thanks everybody for listening and participating. Thanks again, panelists, and enjoy the rest of the conference.